Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Stoddard Kennedy. Chapter 35. Science and Health Again. Among the many activities crowded into the 3 years covered in the previous chapter, not the least, as far as Mrs. Eddy was concerned, was the revision of science and health. For more than 30 years, this was, for her, a constant devoted labor. Her main purpose in these revisions was, of course, to elucidate her meaning. True, in the earlier editions, she used the book as a platform to deal with special developments and to right wrongs, as she believed, adding chapters or inserting paragraphs which were afterwards deleted or modified as the occasion for them passed. But in the main, her one thought was to make more readily apprehensible the principle set forth in the first edition. As already stated, the book is unique. The fact that its author never read it through consecutively in the 30 or more years that elapsed between the first edition and the last is proof sufficient that she had no thought of fashioning it after any accepted model. Like Emily Dickinson, Walt Whitman, Carlyle, St. John, and not a few others, this woman had very little respect for convention, either in her grammar, her style, or her use of words. She bent and even twisted all three to her service in any way she wished, if by so doing she could bring out her point more clearly or more strikingly. In the fashion of some advertising, she would, it may be ventured, have gladly turned a word upside down or spelled it backwards, if by so doing she could have compelled for it the attention she desired. As has been seen also, she formed her style in a tortuous age of English literature. The florid grandiosity of the 40s and 50s of last century was a handicapping period in which to serve an apprenticeship for one whose objective was not literature in the ordinary meaning of the word, but merely the use of language for the promulgation of a revolutionary idea. The more clearly did she see this idea, the more easily did she divest herself of the ornamentation of her earlier style, until, in her later years, she had a terseness of presentation and a cogency of content which place her in a class by herself. In her earlier writings, she labors with the rest. As the demand for her book increased, and as a consequence was subject to more widespread criticism from a literary point of view, Mrs. Eddy seems to have realized that however little she might care for literary convention, the fact remained that breaches of it tended to divert attention from the main purpose of her writing and concentrate it on a very minor essential. Early in 1885, therefore, she determined that the next edition of Science and Health, as far as literary form was concerned, should be more in line with accepted usage. To this end, she adopted a wise course. She enlisted the services of one of the editors of the University Press, a retired Unitarian minister named James Henry Wigan, to act as proofreader for the 15th edition of her book, which she was then preparing. She was quite explicit with Mr. Wiggin as to what she wanted done. In a statement made to the New York American some 20 years later, she declares that because some critic had insisted that her book was as ungrammatical as it was misleading, she employed Mr. Wiggin, a man whose authority was generally recognized, to defend my grammatical construction, and also to avail myself of his criticisms of my statement of Christian Science, which criticisms would enable me to explain more clearly the points that might seem ambiguous to the reader. Any comparison of the first edition of Science and Health with the 15th or 16th or any later edition shows clearly that this is exactly what Mr. Wiggin did. The actual diction in all editions is as unquestionably from the same hand as are different varieties of an individual signature. Often it is possible to trace the hand of Mr. Wiggin all too clearly, as when one of the author's refreshing departures from literary convention is rather pedantically sacrificed to the demand of the purist. But for the most part, his work seems to have been confined to the very valuable and necessary task of bringing the style into line with accepted standards. James Henry Wiggin was an interesting character. If fate had decided that he should have flourished in London in the closing years of the 18th century, instead of in Boston in the closing years of the 19th, he might have found a place along with Paley and Butler and a host of lesser lights among the immortals. He reveled in dialectics. Like Sheridan, he had no sooner won his case than, if nothing better offered, he would gladly turn around and argue with eager conviction for the other side. For several years, he wrote for the Christian Science Journal over the nom de plume Fair Play, defending Mrs. Eddy's teaching against all comers. But as his private correspondence sufficiently shows, he did so only because he saw the weak places in the attacker's armor, and the cut and thrust of the melee gave him much joy. He did a good work on Science and Health, and the 16th edition is rightly regarded as one of the landmarks in the history of the book. A formal announcement of the appearance of this edition in the Journal for January 1886 says, "Attention is called to this volume. It is worth the notice, not only of Christian Scientists, but of all who are interested in the progress of truth. It is from the University Press, Cambridge, and this is a guarantee for its typographical appearance. All the material of the other editions is herein retained, but all of it has been carefully revised and rewritten by Mrs. Eddy and greatly improved. The arrangement of the chapters has been changed. One new chapter has been added on the Apocalypse, giving an exposition of the bearings on Christian Science of the 12th chapter of Revelation, to which it is believed by Mrs. Eddy to particularly relate. A special feature is a full index, prepared especially for this edition by a competent gentleman. In these days, no important book has a right to come before the public without a proper index." The competent gentleman did a good job. His index proved to be an excellent one and served the readers of Science and Health well for many years. All the time that this work was going forward, the Quimby controversy, already alluded to, was moving unremittingly from point to point. In fact, controversy over Mrs. Eddy, or some form of her teaching, was the order of almost every day. Wherever the movement planted itself, in however small a way, right there, within a very short time, a flame of debate would spring up like that caused by a wind-blown spark in a grass fire. But throughout, in spite of, or rather it would seem because of it all, the movement prospered prodigiously. For Mrs. Eddy, the days of poverty were left a long way behind. In the winter of 1887, she purchased, as a residence, the large house, 385 Commonwealth Avenue in Boston, which is still used as a residence for the first reader of the Mother Church. She retained the house on Columbus Avenue as the headquarters of the Metaphysical College, and thus secured for herself greater privacy, which she sorely needed. The move also served to lessen, for a time at least, the growing tide of sycophancy and adulation, which more and more at this period seems to have filled her with anxiety. One last thread to be gathered up in these years, before going on to consider the amazing aftermath of the Chicago triumph, is another visit which George Glover paid to his mother in the summer of this year. George Glover is now a man of 45. He has a wife and several children, and they live in Lead City, South Dakota, and he is still interested in mining. When Gilbert Eddy died in 1882, Mrs. Eddy had written to her son, begging him to come to her. But George Glover did not even answer this letter. All his life, as far as his mother was concerned, it was the same. Almost from birth, his feet were planted in a road which led him away from his mother. And just so long as they both were alive, their intercourse, if so it may be called, was characterized by the same trend. Long efforts to secure reunion, at any rate on the mother's part, were marked, when achieved, by an outward semblance of happiness, all too surely doomed to disappointment and failure. Then long periods of silence or intermittent communication, then another effort at reunion with the same results. This had been the way of it in Boston in 1877, at the time of George's strange encounter with Richard Kennedy. And it is not surprising that when, in the summer of 1887, Mrs. Eddy received a letter from her son announcing his intention of coming to Boston with his family to pay her a visit, she should have regarded the matter with no little uneasiness. Their lives had grown utterly apart. If they had little in common in 1877, they had practically nothing in 1887. Mrs. Eddy wrote to him frankly, telling him how she must have quiet in her home and opportunity to do her work without distraction, how that she still looked forward to a day when they could be reunited if he would only reform his ways, but that now she had a duty to others to perform. And it was a duty that must be performed. George Glover was, it appears, the kind of man who simply could not realize the importance of such niceties, as he would have called them. A prospector's life could be interrupted at any moment, and he evidently felt very much in the mood for a trip east with his wife and children. He wrote to Mrs. Eddy, notifying her that he was on the way. Mrs. Eddy, on receipt of his letter, determined to make the best of it. She received him gladly when he arrived, introduced him and his wife to her students, took a house for them in Chelsea, and appeared with the children on one or two occasions on the platform at the Sunday afternoon meetings. But George Glover was still very much the square peg in the round hole, and his wife, likely much more at home in a mining camp than in Boston, fitted no better than her husband into the very special menage which Mrs. Eddy at this time was obliged to maintain. Slowly but steadily, as the weeks passed, the futility of the effort became more and more apparent, and at last George Glover and his family went out west once more, not to reappear on the scene for another decade. Meanwhile, Mrs. Eddy was feeling more and more the need for someone who would stand to her in the same relation as her son might have stood if things had been different. Calvin Fry was faithful and efficient, but he was a man singularly lacking in imagination. To him, routine was one of the great joys of life and one of its outstanding satisfactions. He was devoted to Mrs. Eddy, and whatever happened to be her vision of the moment was the limit of his desire. Mrs. Eddy, in whom the maternal instinct, in spite of its many frustrations, was very strong, felt always the need for warm affection in those with whom she lived and worked, as there is abundant evidence to prove. True, she had already written in her book, Science and Health, that if existence without personal friends would be to anyone a blank, then the time would surely come when he would be solitary, left without sympathy, friends will betray and enemies will slander until the lesson is sufficient to exalt you. For man's extremity is God's opportunity. But whatever her meaning and purpose in writing these words, she herself always sought the love that is expressed in personal friendships, and hesitated not at all to say so. The memoirs of her household associates show this time after time. Caroline Foss Geiger speaks of her fond kisses, and Martha Wilcox tells how Mrs. Eddy, with tears streaming down her face, begged her never to leave her side. The laborious efforts of the traditionalists to paint a pale and unearthly leader, forever platitudinizing on love instead of practicing it, are effectively discredited by any one of a thousand episodes such as that in which she drew Mrs. Wilcox to her, patted her affectionately, and said, "How nice and fat you are." And so, in the first moments of her final, rather bitter conclusion, that she had nothing to hope from her son in the way of aid for her work or comfort for her daily living. She cast around to see if there was not someone who would take the place of what he might have been. As she did so, she seems to have thought more and more about the young physician, Ebenezer Foster, who had accompanied her party when they went to Chicago. Ebenezer J. Foster was a graduate of Hahnemann Medical College in Philadelphia. About 40 years of age, he had, until 1887, been practicing homeopathy in Waterbury, a little mountain town in Vermont. And the whole course of his life seemed to be set towards his establishment there as a country and small town doctor. Then, one day, an old friend who had long been sick came to him and told him how he had been healed completely through reading a book called Science and Health by a woman named Mary Baker Eddy. Dr. Foster was very deeply impressed, and shortly afterwards, being in Boston on a visit to an aunt, he went to call on Mrs. Eddy, with the result that next day he had joined one of her classes, which was just then forming. He was completely won over, returned to Waterbury for a time, but later gave up his practice there and came to live in Boston, opening an office and devoting himself with enthusiasm to the practice of the new teaching. From the first, Mrs. Eddy seems to have seen in Ebenezer Foster someone who might afford her the help she so sorely needed. She invited him to accompany her to Chicago, and shortly after her return to Boston, grateful for all the help he had been to her, and faced with another bitter crisis in her movement, she offered to adopt him as her son. He gladly assented, and so it was arranged. In her petition to the court, Mrs. Eddy stated that said Foster is now associated with your petitioner in business, home life, and life work, and she needs such interested care and relationship. And so, on the 5th of November, 1888, the legal arrangements being complete, Ebenezer Foster assumed the name of Foster Eddy and entered Mrs. Eddy's household as her son. But before this had been accomplished, the whole face of things in Boston had been changed. Through all the years of her progress, Mrs. Eddy had been slowly learning to distrust, as she expressed it, both tear and triumph. It was not without reason that she had viewed the outbursts of enthusiasm in Chicago with a heavy heart. The train carrying her back to Boston had scarcely reached the South Station before she was faced with a crisis which threatened to disrupt the whole movement and caused her to make a decision which, for audacity and courage, has scarcely been equaled in the history of any great movement.